And now,
the definition.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends,
I'm
delighted to come to Davos.
The
small, beautiful town in the Alps is indeed an important window through which we can take the pulse of the global economy. People from around the world come here to exchange ideas and insights which will broaden their vision. This makes the WEF annual meeting a cost-effective brainstorming event, which I would like to call Schwab Economics.
As you know,
in 10 days' time,
the
Chinese will celebrate the Lunar Chinese New Year.
在这一个时期啊, 中国国内都在忙碌着,
around this time, it is all buzz in China. People visit
叫做拜年,
their relatives
通过拜年呢,
and friends.
联络感情,
in this way, they will strengthen their bond and friendship. So this time, my wife and I and the other members of the delegation come to Davos to pay our respect, to say New Year greetings to Switzerland and the whole world. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. These are the words used by Charles Dickens to describe the world after the Industrial Revolution. Today, we also live in a world of contradictions. On the one hand, with growing material wealth and advances in science and technology, human civilization has developed as never before. On the other hand, however, frequent regional conflicts, global challenges like terrorism and refugees, as well as poverty, unemployment, and the widening income gap have all added to the uncertainties of the world. Many people are wondering, what has gone wrong with our world? To answer this question, one must first track the source of the problem. Some people blame economic globalization for the chaos in our world. Economic globalization was once viewed as the treasure cave found by Alibaba in the Arabian Nights. But now, it has become the Pandora's box in the eyes of many. The international community finds itself in a heated debate on economic globalization. So today I wish to address the global economy in the context of economic globalization. The point I want to make is that many of the problems troubling the world are not caused by economic globalization. For instance, the refugee waves from the Middle East and North Africa in recent years have become a global concern. Several million people have been displaced, And some small children lost their lives while crossing the rough sea. This is indeed heartbreaking to us. It is war, conflict, and regional turbulence that have created this problem. And the solution to this problem lies in making peace, promoting reconciliation, and restoring stability. The international financial crisis is another example. It is not an inevitable outcome of economic globalization. Rather, it is the consequence of excessive chase of profit by financial capital and grave failure of financial regulation. There's no point in blaming economic globalization for the world's problems, as that is simply not the case, and it will not help solve the problems. From the historical perspective, economic globalization results from growing social productivity and is the natural outcome of scientific and technological advances. It is not something created by any individuals or any countries. Economic globalization has powered global growth and facilitated the movement of goods and capital. Advances in science, technology and civilization, and interactions among peoples. But we should also recognize that economic globalization is a double-edged sword. When the global economy is under downward pressure, it is hard for us to make the cake of global economy bigger. As a matter of fact, it may even shrink, and this will strain the relations between growth and distribution, between capital and labor, and between efficiency and equity. Both developed and developing countries have felt the punch. The voices against globalization have laid bare the pitfalls in the process of economic globalization. And we need to take that seriously. The Chinese tend to say, honey melons hang from bitter vines, sweet dates grow on thistles and thorns. In a philosophical sense, nothing is perfect in the world. One would fail to see the full picture if he claims something is perfect simply because of its merits, or if he views something as useless just because of its defects. Whether you like it or not, the global economy is the big ocean that you cannot escape from. Any attempt to cut off flows of capital, technologies, products, industries, and people between economies and channel the waters in the ocean back into isolated lakes and creeks. This is simply not possible. And indeed, it runs counter to the historical trend. The history of mankind tells us that problems are not to be feared. What should concern us is refusing to face up to the problems and not knowing what to do about them. In the face of both opportunities and challenges of economic globalization, the right thing to do is to seize every opportunity, jointly meet challenges, and chart the right course for economic globalization. At the APEC Economic Leaders Meeting in late 2016, I spoke about the need to make the process of economic globalization more invigorated, more inclusive, and more sustainable. We should act proactively and manage economic globalization as appropriate, so as to release its positive impact and rebalance the process of economic globalization. We should follow the general trend, proceed from our respective national conditions, and embark on the right pathway of integrating into economic globalization at the right pace. We should strike a balance between efficiency and equity to ensure that different countries, different social strata, and different groups of people all share in the benefits of economic globalization. This is a responsibility that leaders of our times must take on. And the people around the world expect nothing less from us.
Definition of economics talks of the description given by different economists. Economists have defined economics differently, which can be broadly classified into four categories, that is, wealth definition, welfare definition, scarcity definition, and growth definition. So let's talk about them one by one in detail now. Wealth is a measure of the value of all the assets of the worth owned by a person, community, company, or country. For individuals, net worth is the most common expression of wealth, while countries measures by GDP. Wealth definition was given by father of economics, Adam Smith, in his book An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of Wealth of Nation. He defined economics as an inquiry into the factor that determines the wealth of a country and its growth. But this definition gives importance to wealth rather than social welfare and scarcity of resources. Moving on to the second definition that revolves around welfare of mankind. Welfare is the provision of the minimal level of well-being and social support for all citizens. Welfare can take a variety of forms, such as monetary payments, subsidies and vouchers, or housing assistance. Alfred Marshall says, economics is the study of mankind. In the ordinary business of life, it examines that part of individual and social action which is most independently connected with attainment and use of material requisites of wealth. Critics believe that Alfred Marshall ignored the measurement of welfare in monetary terms, scarcity of resources, and economics growth. Scarcity means shortage, want, lack, or limited. This definition considers economics as a science which studies human behavior as a relationship between ends and scarce means which have alternative uses. This definition is accepted worldwide as a scarcity definition, but I guess he missed out concentrating upon welfare and growth aspects. Economic growth is the increase in the market value of goods and services produced by an economy over time. it conventionally measured by the percent rate of increase in real GDP. But Robbins and Marshall missed. Samuelson's picked that up. Well, according to Paul A. Samuelson's, economics is the study of how people and society choose with or the without use of money to employ scarce productive resources that could have alternative uses, to produce various commodities over time and distribute them for consumption now or in the future amongst various persons and groups in the society. It is the most comprehensive definition of all. It combines the essential features of welfare and society along with growth. Thank you, class.
This week, Conflict Zone is in New York,
Berlin,
Kiev, Leipzig,
Hamburg,
Brussels, Potsdam.
Brexit, the euro crisis, disagreement about refugees. Are we witnessing the last days of the European Union?
I don't believe it are the last days of the European Union, but it are maybe the last days of this European Union.
The English are the ones who will feel the damage most. It's almost as if he wants the British to suffer
There is no revenge or lesson giving sentiment. It is clear that, I mean, we fully respect the choice of the Brits. We need now to focus on what needs to be done among 27 and notably within the Eurozone and the new investment policy to boost growth.
But it would be very good for you if the British suffered, wouldn't it?
No.
Because
why?
What if they make a go of it? What if their economy grows? What if their employment grows? What if all the economic indicators turn green? How are you going to persuade your citizens here, who are labouring with 11.5% unemployment, that it's worth staying in the EU? That makes your job that much harder, doesn't it?
My job is a very difficult one. The job of any...
But a British success would make it even more difficult.
I wish all the success to the Brits. I do not believe that it's the right choice. I fully respect the British choice. I think that it is a deeply wrong choice. And I think that in the medium run, Britain will suffer from that and will regret it.
A lot of apocalyptic warnings in the last few days about what Brexit will mean. Even you said before the referendum, we're looking into the precipice. Is the EU so fragile?
Yes, it is. Since a couple of years, we cannot deny the fact that there are clear tendencies of dissolution. We have tendencies of renationalization in many countries.
Germany's Deputy Chancellor, Sigmar Gabriel, warned just days ago that unless the British exit from the EU was handled properly, the European Union, he said, would go down the drain. It's that fragile that you'll go down the drain if you get this wrong.
I think that the Union is going through a very delicate phase. I think that the Union cannot afford to remain in the status quo. And I think that the status quo could be the beginning of European disintegration. Whereas what we need is to relaunch on a new basis the European integration process. This is why immediately we have to give efficient answer on growth, security, and youth. And next year, we have to think of a new political pact for the Union, for a ever closer Union.
But these are not new tablets. You're not saying anything new that hasn't been said. Hasn't been said for years.
You don't need to be original. You just need to implement what we say.
What they want to do is to make a split between these three freedoms and the freedom of movement of people. And we shall never accept that. The unity of the four freedoms for all citizens is a key element in this
negotiation. If somebody is negotiating and saying we will never accept that, so where are the negotiations?
No, we will never accept to undo the European Union. You cannot expect that if the British people or majority of the British people want to go out of the European Union, that we shall destroy the European Union. I have to defend the interests of the European citizens. But I have to defend the interests of the German citizens, the Belgian citizens, who want to keep the European Union because it's in their advantage,
yes, but
let's
talk about
it's their
this
work, it's their job.
You think there's a clear danger the European Union will not survive?
Yes, absolutely.
That other countries will leave?
Yes. Yes, I can give you the candidates. I mean, the Netherlands,
Italy,
Austria.
That's the reason why I want to change and reform Europe. This Europe cannot work because member states have mainly all the power.
You want
and
to
if
change.
They don't, and the change is that we need a real European government, what we don't have for the moment. That doesn't mean a commission
of 28.
So let's
talk about now.
And that
you,
means
talk about
change
now.
The European
I
Parliament.
Mean, UKIP, Front National, Alternative for Germany. Doesn't the growth of national movements show that the idea of the EU is failing?
No, it's a test for the idea. We have to give answers to the questions. The uncertainty of people because of internal and external security, consequences of globalization, that part of our society feel that they will fall down in the workers' class and in the middle classes partly, where the voters come, both in Brexit as in Le Pen and AfD, it's mostly the same type of voters like it is in Trump.
Competence and failures of the EU offer excellent service to any populist who wants to promote anti-democratic and right-wing things.
How I can contradict you? It's the reality. So but the reality can, it's very good that you say, yeah, this situation,
are you
this European Union
are you
that doesn't work
responsible for the rise of all these populist groups? Yes or no? Who is responsible?
A European Union that doesn't work very well creates automatically populism and nationalism.
So there so is the a responsibility, yes or no?
So the only way to react to this is not to fall into the trap of nationalism and populism, but is to reform the European Union the fastest as possible. That is what I'm saying. I'm saying that the only way to fight against nationalism and populism is to reform the European Union. And if you don't do it, we're going to see in every member state of the European Union, in France, in the Netherlands, in every member state, a rise of nationalism and populism. And we have the duty to tell to the public opinion, if this European Union doesn't work, don't fall in the trap of nationalism and populism, but reform the union.
In a few months, there are elections in France, and Le Pen is today one of the favorites. What will this have for consequences if, after the Brexit, France will be leaded by a president, Madame Le Pen, who is right-wing, who is a racist party, and an anti-European party?
If a country like France would go in such a direction, it would be a disaster for France and all of Europe.
What means a disaster for Europe and France?
It means to going to the past, to going back to nationalism. It means that the old anti-feelings of nations will increase again, and that we go back to that time before the war, that Europeans fight each other and not to try.
Which means it would be the end of the European Union.
I believe so, that a country like France would do that. It would be a major threat in such a direction.
You said the day after the election of Donald Trump that you gave him credit for saying he'd try to bind the wounds of division and be the president for all Americans, which is what they all say, I guess. How is anybody supposed to ever believe a word Donald Trump says after the kind of campaign we've seen?
Well, you don't have to believe everything. You just have to see what's going to happen. I think that's really the question anyway. You know, look, with every presidential candidate, there's always that moment when presidential campaign rhetoric has to turn into presidential policy. And that's, I think, what we're all waiting to see.
But this is a campaign that ran on lies, didn't it? And it ran on quite significant lies, in particular the one that sought to delegitimize America's first black president, saying that he hadn't actually been born in the U.S. when it was quite clear that he had. This went on for years. This is serious lying, isn't it?
Well, this has been a very, very, very divisive campaign. And my advice is that he's got to take steps to rebuild the center. He's right to criticize Washington over its partisanship and inability to forge compromises.
He was right to run a racist campaign.
He's a deal maker, and let's see now if he can make some deals in Washington.
He ran a racist campaign, General.
Jim, I'm nonpartisan.
I understand that, but I'm asking you how you work.
The campaign is over, Tim.
But this wasn't a campaign. This is the man, isn't it? The man ran a racist campaign. How do you get over that?
When Mr. Trump will be the president of the United States, what is your opinion about that?
This has to be seen whether then the Western alliance has still the full credibility that the United States
is
sticks to its values.
Is Mr. Trump credible?
In my opinion, no. He has not the credibility, but he has a chance to prove it.
I'm not going to get into characterizations of this candidate or that candidate. Let's see what President Trump does. Let's see who President-elect Trump picks for his cabinet officials. Let's see what policies begin to emerge.
So it doesn't shock you that 60 million Americans voted for someone who had lied so comprehensively to them during the campaign. What does that say?
Well, let me tell you what the election says, and that is that the Washington elite, if you will, the elite of the coasts, New York and L.A., lost touch with an awful lot of America, the so-called flyover zones, the heartland. And that's what came out and voted in droves. That is what had legitimate concerns that were tapped into by a campaign that was very, very effective.
Look, and the 60 million Americans don't care that they were lied to comprehensively
during the
course
of the campaign. Well, you'll have to ask the 60 million Americans.
But you're not shocked by that?
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Brian Mary Deese. Welcome to another episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. I've been listening to Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the UK. I've been listening to her speech presentation at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And she hit on a few points which I really need to start off this podcast, this week's podcast with, because her presentation really underscored the deficiency, and I mean this, and almost the retardedness, and I mean that, of the upper class and their ability to understand the plight of the average person. Her speech began with her, with many things, but the point that jumped out at me immediately, I think it was within 5 minutes of her speech beginning, was how she characterized the uprising of right and left parties in Europe as exploiting the felt inequality, the misperceived idea among the lower class that they were experiencing some economic turmoil. She didn't put it that way. She said that they felt that the system wasn't unfair. Of course, she did not elaborate on this, but just said they felt that things weren't going that well. Now, this is coded language that I've been hearing a lot lately, and actually I heard it a lot during Barack Obama's tenure as president too. He would say, and this is actually extended to Donald Trump, I've heard him use similar language, but he would say when speaking about police officers, we need to make sure that people feel that the police are treating them well, that they feel that the police are there for their benefit. And this word, feel, struck me. Because just because you feel something does not mean it's correct. In fact, when you look at, as I've done briefly, the psychological history development of advertisement, you realize that what was proposed back in the early 1900s and actually implemented during World War I, that great loop that I've been thinking about recently, the fact that 100 years ago, the world, Western Europe, was engaged in the first industrial war of the century. There would be two of them. Pardon the noise. It is often said, of course, that history does not rhyme, and it's good that we're not in a repeat of that industrial war. But it seems that over the last 8 years, 8, 9, 10 years, the idea of feeling that things are looking right, not actually being able to see that they are right, being able to tell that they are right, is the code word of the era. So when she says that these people feel that things aren't going right, she is honestly saying that their perspective is incorrect. Now, she doesn't say this. Neither did Obama when he talked about black people and the cops. But this is what they sense, is that the perspective is incorrect, that this is just a way that a few people are misfeeling, they're misusing their emotions, and that things are actually going really good. This is absolutely retarded, and don't forget, the word retarded has nothing to do with handicap. It has to do with holding oneself back. And since she mentioned conservatism in her speech, one of the primary concepts of conserving is that you hold something back. You restrain something. You don't allow it to progress forward. So I am not out of line by using the word retarded. Time that we grow up, ladies and gentlemen. That, to me, set the entire tone of her talk. Because it said to me that she wasn't really looking to ameliorate the problems of the average person. She just wanted them to feel like things were getting better. Now, I'll give you a great example of U.S. history that I know of when things felt like they were getting better, and yet within a short period of time, that feeling went away really quick. And that's the civil rights movement. Companies and government poured in tons of money to educate and elevate displaced black people as their land was being taken from them. That's a part of the civil rights movement that you do not hear about. After World War II, dozens of black communities, strong black communities with businesses and organizations to hold the families together, all of that was demolished by what would later be called urban renewal, but it was the sprawl to create suburban space for white folks. So when black people started getting tired of that, among other things, because that was what was happening in the North mostly, when they started joining the fight for civil rights, and they started saying, well, we want economic power then, the government started dumping money to try to build that capitalist American base. The only problem was black people were also anti-war. So then their feelings were, yeah, things are getting pretty decent. You know, I know kid who's doing well. I know woman who's doing well. You know, they're starting to move up, so maybe I can get in here and start moving up as well. But as soon as that started happening and they realized, oh, well, these people are also very anti-war and they're showing up for protests and what have you, then big business started withdrawing their money. Because now you're going against our real interest. And this is the problem with the whole idea that she's touting, is that she's thinking, well, if you're feeling like things are good, then things are good. You can take a drug and feel like things are good, but things aren't good. As I wonder if some of these people are on sometimes, but that's another whole nother show. My concern is 5, 6, 7 years from now, okay, you start putting money into making globalization work for everybody. So 7 years from now, when things look like they're improving decently, and people say, well, now we really do want the government to grow a bit and to work definitely for us and not for business, if that project's going to come to a screeching halt because now you don't like the programs that the government's putting in place. In fact, she talked about this a little bit. She said, well, I believe government should be there to work for the average person, specifically the person who is the most least advantaged. Now, that's another code word, least advantaged. Understand, because I've heard many people, it's funny to me, I've heard many middle-class people make this argument. I've heard some lower class people make this argument, but for them, I just look and I say, do you understand what you were communicating to me right now? But they make this argument that people who are poor because of their own choices. If they had chose better, then they would be obviously in a better economic category. When, of course, all statistics, all mathematics, all assembled data. So this is absolutely untrue. The fact of the matter is most people who are born in one class die in that class. It's a caste system. And indeed, the corporations make it a caste system. I was on a page having to do with fascism recently. A guy actually produces videos actually touting fascism. And whereas he seemingly has read a lot of books, he quotes some books, most of them obscure that we've never really heard of because they're about fascism. The one point that I make to him and that I make to her when she says, well, government needs to be there to advocate for these people, is a weakened government that does not sit on the same level as the corporation. And what I mean on the same level is they're actually slightly higher because they got to enforce laws that govern the corporation, cannot advocate anything. Fascism, as with capitalism, is a rigidly hierarchical system. And what we have seen over the past 70 years, 80 years, since World War II essentially, is this whole idea of liberalizing markets, and actually she talked about this, which is, I'm starting to see when politicians and rich people talk about liberalizing democracy, they're talking about liberalizing democracy for the people that they work for, mainly corporations. They don't care about democracy when it comes to people. They're talking about liberalizing corporate democracy. And corporate democracy has nothing to do with the internal structure. It has to do with the ability for them to exercise their power over people. Now, she tries to argue differently. She tries to argue differently, or seemingly argue differently, or suggest differently. But this just isn't true. Capitalism, again, like fascism, is rigidly hierarchical. And what we have seen in the past 80, 90 years, 70 years, is the hierarchy, which was kind of set in place before World War I, where
the government exercised slight power over corporations, and then in the 30s, it exercised a lot more because people got tired of that, and the world was driven into a depression because of corporate greed and, truthfully, malfeasance. Malfeasance. What happened then after that was there was a battle to push government down the hierarchical ladder so that corporations can run it. And what we've seen, particularly since the 70s and the 80s, really since the era of Reagan, is corporation making good on their promises to stymie the control that government has over them. And thus, their idea of democracy is the government needs to have no power, and if it has any power, it feeds right into the cancerous concept of the corporate. I really sometimes call it the corporate oversoul. It runs things, it sucks energy, it kills things, it obliterates communities. It's like a patch of cancer over multiple societies, you know, over multiple communities. That's what it is. And so when she talks about government having to have the ability to advocate for the least among people, the least advantage among people, she is saying that she still doesn't want the government controlling what corporations do. She just wants them to be able to look at the people and say, look, we're advocating for these things. We're advocating for these things. But here's the thing. Advocating doesn't necessarily mean doing anything. There's many advocates out there doing work. Do they get any sort of progress on the agenda that they're trying to accomplish? Hell no. Most advocates are useless, and they know it. Because if you don't have the money behind you, you're not the system is built for money. And if you're an advocate and you don't have the money, who the hell cares for you? So the corporations now are saying, well, we need to, back up a little bit. Because she's saying what they're saying, and they're saying already that we need to have international rules that everybody plays and abides by. Here's the problem with that. Corporate CEOs and what have you say that when they're in front of cameras, when they're in front of people. But do we see this? No, we don't see this. Again, the last year of Obama's tenure in office, what did we see? We seen EpiPens drop from $59 to over $500 because market rules said you can gouge people if you believe they will pay for the product that you have. Anyone can tell me anything they want about morals. But if you're a corporation, then you are a psychopath. You have no moral. You have no concept of morality. You have no concept of consciousness. So you can't talk to me about morals. You create a killer and it kills. That's what it does. Cancer does not care what it destroys as long as it is fed. And oftentimes, as long as it grows. Wait a minute, what did I just say? Cancer does not care what it destroys as long as it has been fed. Do you hear me when I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen? Corporations, capitalism, it is a cancer. That's all it does. When you hear people talk about, we need to expand markets, we need to have economic growth, what they are talking about is their business interests, their corporations. Look up what corporation actually means. Jeez, getting excited about this. Anyway, when they talk about that, when they say we need economic growth, we need to develop more markets, this is the cancer talking. Enough is never enough. So therefore, the idea of actually building up societies, building sustainable societies, you never reach that point because they're always trying to grow beyond ever reaching that point. And this is what she does not get. She talks the good game. And then at the end, by the way, she says, oh, well, we're in a complex geopolitical atmosphere. When the hell hasn't it been complex? Tell me this. If you can tell me when the quote geopolitical field has not been complex, I'll rethink what I'm saying. Because at no time in the past 500 years has the geopolitical reality been any less complex. But I digress, because the reality is the system is so sick. The people who are within the system are so sick that they're mouthing the same platitudes, because truthfully, they don't know. They don't know how to think outside of what they have been taught. Education, ladies and gentlemen, is the greatest waste of energy if it doesn't teach you to think critically. It is the greatest waste of energy if it doesn't teach you to think critically. And these people ain't thinking critically. They're thinking, well, how do we save this system? The system is done. People are telling you right now they want something different. And either you will deliver it or you will be swept aside, guaranteed. I know people don't like it when I start talking about spiritual concepts, but deal with it. People, their souls and spirits are tired. I see it. I read about it. I sense it. Think about it. Outside of politics, we'll take the whole political message that I was talking about and we'll put that aside. I want you to really sit down, right? I want you to sit down right now. If you can. And if you can't, I want you to do this later. Sit. I mean, honestly, sit. Turn off the TV. Turn off the computer. Turn off the phone. And just sit. And I want you to think. What was the last event that you remember comes to your mind? Just let it float to the top of your mind. Where you were so happy and joyous and totally connected to everybody who was around you. I want you to really think about that. Just whatever. What is the first thing that comes to your mind? Don't overthink it. Just whatever the first thing is. It may be a blip. Usually when you do these things, they're blips. But really, as it blips, catch it. Just catch it with your mind and open it. Let it open. And relive it. Let your body feel what you felt there. Feel if it was in the sun, if it was in the snow or what have you. Feel the weather around you. Feel the presence. Feel the greatness. And then I want you to think about this. What age were you? Now, of course, I think the older you are listening to this, the more likely it is that there's going to be, you know, some sort of a range. But then I want you to think after that, okay, so what age were you? Now put that aside. Put it aside. Now still sitting there with that great feeling. I want you to go to the next great event where you felt connected to everybody. You felt connected to yourself. Not life-changing event. Just something. And I want you again, just feel it. And I want you to then again, what age were you? Set that one aside. Do it one more time. Get yourself a third one. What age were you? Write it down. All three of them, write it down. And then briefly, why, what made them happy? And don't go with the surface stuff. Okay, because so-and-so who passed away was there. No, no, no. The essence of it. What made you feel whole? So, okay, so maybe so-and-so was there who passed away or who moved to, you know, California and you live in Jersey or what have you. But what was that bond that made that so complete? What were you confident of internally? What made you feel whole? Why am I asking you this? Because it is that essence that this social structure called capitalism seems to destroy and feed off of. I did not watch the first Matrix movie. Honestly, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you this and it's going to shock you. Your mouth is going to fall open. I didn't watch the first Matrix movie until last year. Didn't watch it. Haven't watched the other two, but didn't watch the first Matrix movie until last year. I, of course, had heard a lot about it. I had heard many references to it. I had even seen multiple videos, probably about two or three dozen videos, which had to do with metaphysics, and it was breaking down the concepts of the Matrix from a metaphysical level and from a scientific level in some instances. But what none of them seemed to propose was the metaphorical similarities that the Matrix presented to the modern and present and really the existing social structure called capitalism. When we enter into buildings to work, we give our energy, and we know this. This is literally in the economic literature. We give our time, which is precious. People say the element of time. I don't believe they're misstating it. I think time is literally an element. Shamans tell you that you can actually reverse it. You can reverse it. You can adjust it. You can move it. Things like that. But it might actually be an element. If it is or isn't, though, that's, you know, up to you. But we give our time. We give our precious energy. And again, this economic literature, they tell you this. People are giving their time, their energy, which they could be spending on their family. They actually should be spending an amount of it on their family. But also, we give our attention, which people underestimate the idea of paying attention. That's another level of energy, which comes directly from the mind and the intelligence and the intuition. So we are putting all of this energy into this thing. This thing which sucks on it and can evict us at any time. We are powerless. We are told to give every ounce of ourselves to the corporation. We are supposed to work there and love working there until we die. And the corporation owes us nothing. It is the same system that is spoken of in the Matrix, where you have this large machine keeps birthing humans to suck their energy. That's all it does, to suck their energy. And that's what we are. We are nothing but batteries to the corporations. We often say we are cash cows. You know, you've heard that statement before, that that phrase, a cash cow. This used to be bigger in the 90s, I know. I apologize, but that's, you know, that's when I came of age. But you've heard that, cash cows. Well, think about it. What the heck is a cow but a piece of cattle? If the corporate world can look at you and say, well, you're a cash cow. Oh, yeah. I love you because you're a cash cow. If they can pass rules that make it impossible for you to have any recourse when they fire you, called right to work legislation. Oh my God, the most Orwellian legislation ever. Right to work legislation where you have no power. It's right to fire. That's what it means. If they can do that, then you tell me, what good is it? What good is that system? She says that it's created the most, well, she phrases it, I was about to phrase it wrong. She phrases it as an advancement of technology, an advancement of societies that liberalizing economies has given the world. The reality is, that is untrue. The, quote, advancement of the world has taken place because the superpowers, the super economic powers, which arose after World War II, were competing with each other. And so they had to show that their systems worked, at least in part. Of course, we know there's a history of the United States where it was pacifying, murdering, exiling people in their hemisphere who didn't want to go along with their capitalist agenda, which tells you what capitalism really is about. Murder, exploitation, assassination, exilement. That's what it's about. That is what it's about. But she's, I was watching a video earlier, and this individual explained historians as crafting together a narrative in order to make a story, essentially, out of events. And then he said in retort to that, comparatively, revisionists go in and say, oh, well, this is not actually how things are looking. The narrative is incorrect. It's missing a whole bunch of points. So we got to go in and we have to put the points in. He reversed it, actually. The revisionists, just like conservatives try to paint themselves as being the true holders of democracy, but yet they'll say, well, we're not really for democracy, we're for republicanism. But then they'll always use the term of democracy, or the phraseology of democracy, to put forward their proposals. They're dishonest with that, and they do it a lot. But historians, actually, have not been the ones who wanted to create narratives. There have been, I don't even know what to call them. They're like fourth or fifth rate historians who have built their libraries on that, on creating narratives out of multiple events. And actually, by the way, most of these people can be considered conservatives who do that. But they are not considered true historians. They are considered revisionists. You see what they've done? They've taken two words and they've swapped the meaning. So he was talking about this, and I know where he gets it from. He listens to the guy Stefano Mullinex, or however you say his last name, who I've listened to. And while the man has some brilliant points sometime, about 10, 20, sometimes 30% of his time, he comes out of the libertarian aspect, which is very unconscious and deliberately so of the realities which built some of the things which he's railing against. So we won't go into it, but I see that's where he got it from. The guy who wrote the book, which he was quoting, has to do with psychohistory, and I actually want to get the book because I think there's some brilliant points in it. He breaks the psychohistorical evolution of Europe down into, I think it's 6 categories, maybe 7, and that's the idea he floated in the introduction, that revisionist's job was to go in and say, well, yeah, that's the narrative that you're proposing. This is what we actually want to add to it because there's more. It's more complex in the narrative. That's the reverse. The revisionists in the history of the United States actually were, for instance, the losers of the Civil War in the United States. They were the revisionists. So instead of the war being about slavery, they revised the historical texts and said, well, it wasn't really about slavery. It was about states' rights. It was about slavery. It wasn't really about black people. It was about states' rights. It was about black people. It really wasn't about... You get the point. But that's what they did. And this has been... This has actually happened so much historically. So when I hear her talk, she sounds like a revisionist. And I've heard many people who sound just like her. They sound like revisionists, where they can't wrap their head around the mess that they created. So being narcissistic and being psychopathic, they have to create a narrative which enables them to feel good with the outcome and to relieve themselves of all guilt. And when they can't do that, then you get what Bill O'Reilly and what other conservatives like to do, which is muddy the argument. Push the boundaries out so far that you can fit anything in it. That is where the idea of going out and getting all of... Sorry about that. That is where the idea exists for getting all of these events and just throwing them in there. So, for instance, I'll give you a great example, which is kind of... For instance, Abraham Lincoln has a very detailed track record of really believing black people were inferior. He really did. He really felt like black people were inferior to white folks. And, you know, maybe it was a sign of the times, but that's just what he felt. He wasn't a great emancipator because he loved black people and thought they were righteous or anything. He thought they were inferior. But people will go and they'll say, well, he said this good thing about black people, you know, when he was 32. Or remember when he was 21 and he met this black guy and he didn't, you know, he had the opportunity to have him whipped and decided not to. This is an attempt to expand the borders to the point where the reality of who he was, the overwhelming evidence says that he thought black people were inferior. But you keep adding this stuff, and maybe you can change that perception. This is what they're doing now. Opening up the argument, Theresa May opened up the argument, Prime Minister May, with the fact that left and right parties were exploiting the situation, and the fact that she opened it up like that told me automatically that this was going to be a revisionist piece. Now, I will say and I will admit, I have not listened to the Chinese president, his take on things, but because he actually gave the keynote address. But I will remind you that the CEO of Alibaba, CEO Ma, said of the United States that it should have been building to take care of its people. And I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, if you live in the States, I don't have to really tell you this, but I'm going to say it anyway. We are fast, just hurtling towards a reality that people are not really seeing. People talk about private property. You have a property class, which is not who people think. When they, you know, they hear middle class, they think, oh yeah, I'm property class. When the wealthy are talking about the property class, they're not talking about you. They're talking about themselves. And what they're doing, what they're setting up, is a system to nickel and dime you to death. Now, I'm going to tell you like this. I don't believe it's going to succeed. I actually think that this economic structure is heading for a dramatic downturn in the next, my mind says 15 to 24 months. I'm hoping it takes a little bit longer than that. I'm hoping it's like 4 to 5 years. But I think it's coming, and I think it's going to be here quick, and I think people are not going to know what hit them. Because Donald Trump is throwing this country into turmoil. People are not happy. People will not be happy. He was not elected by a majority. This is the second time that's happened, which I still say, if, you know, I'm not even going to, you know, deify Hillary Clinton as if she didn't have her own problems. She did. But you have to honestly think, why would the corporations want Donald Trump more than Hillary Clinton? If Hillary Clinton was really the neoliberal candidate, if she was really the neoliberal candidate. Brad Friedman from Brad Blog made an interesting observation the other day. He said that if three people in every voting district in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin had voted for Hillary Clinton, three people, it would have swung the election and Hillary Clinton would have won. So I started thinking, and this is, I'm not supporting anything that is suggestive of a Russian plot, but I started thinking about something. Friends of mine that I know, they have been hacked by people on their computer, and the individual will often go in and use their system, their Wi-Fi, and what have you, by inserting a back door. One friend who's actually, he's a computer tech, was telling me a couple of years ago now, that it's hard to spot people like that who's not malicious, because all they want to do is just basically take what you have. However, this made me think. Let's say you're Russia, and you want to throw the election to Donald Trump because maybe you want to get back at the United States for what they did to you back in the 90s. And by the way, see Empire Files, U.S.-Russia connection. I think it's two parts of them. Go ahead and see them. They're great. But are you going to direct your hackers to hack into the machines, which, by the way, are very hackable? There's no question about it. They're hackable. The main terminals are hackable. You've had professors and computer experts saying this for years. They've been saying it for years. So you hack in, and you have to determine, how are you going to throw the election? Are you going to make sure that, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people suddenly appear so it looks like it's wrong? Or, where possible, are you going to insert 100 here, 50 here, 75 there? Disperse it around, and then miss some places so people don't get suspicious. Is that how you're going to do it? See, because that's how I would think they would do it. Instead of the United States, which does things, you know, so overt that you look and you go, really? Yeah, that was the United States. Come on. But it got me thinking about that. So Donald Trump is throwing things into chaos. As I said, I'm giving him a year. I want to see what, you know, what he's doing, what he's about. But don't sit on your feet, ladies and gentlemen. Prepare. Prepare, prepare, prepare. Because the state, as it exists, is still very corporate, and the corporation is a rationing system, as a man said. The corporation is a rationing system. And if the corporation, the system which exists, figures out that in order to survive, it needs to ration its food higher up the chain, you will go hungry. And the politicians won't be able to do anything to help you. This is what makes Prime Minister May's or Theresa May's proposal about the government being able to advocate for the least advantage so unrealistic. If the power lies in the corporations, the government has no power. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm actually going to take a break, a music break, and I have recorded a few quick comments on a few other topics, which I'm going to insert and then end the show. Okay? This is by Meredith.
Oh, no.
Yeah? Cool. Okay.
So much is going on with Donald Trump. And I want to take
a very brief moment away from the segment which you just heard to make a statement which you've heard me make many times, but I want you to remember this, because in resisting Donald Trump, in trying to raise people's conscience and push them towards resisting and push them towards becoming empowered and push them towards really standing up and protesting or what have you. These are barriers which, or this is a barrier which you have to really pierce. History is really being recalibrated, and it has been recalibrated, so that law and order, because now Donald Trump has spoken about law and order. He's spoken about the silent majority, the forgotten American, which even though Richard Nixon talked about this, we have to remember, and Richard Nixon tried painting this as an all-American idea, the same with Donald Trump. You know, this is a 1970s concept, which tells you where our elite, and I use that term loosely, where their mentality really is. Their mentality is still in the 70s and 80s. But he spoke, as did Nixon, about the silent majority, the forgotten American, being white, black, and basically anybody. But that was never who the silent majority was. The silent majority was white conservative people and black people who wanted to still be segregated and mistreated and bow their heads to old master and missus. That's who the silent majority was, and that is who the forgotten American is. When he goes after Muslims, what he does, what nobody, I've heard nobody say this, and nobody point this out, the largest group of Muslims in this country are not Arabs. They're black. When he talks about immigrants in the inner cities, I understand what he's saying, because I get that there's actually a scholarly paper written about the black man as an immigrant. It's from about 50 or 60 years ago, but it's actually true that black people have been treated like they were immigrants in this country for as long as we've been here. And this is something that is notable. So, when you talk to people, particularly when you talk to Euro-Americans, and when I say Euro-Americans, I ain't talking about the ones who were actually born on the European continent and then moved over here. I'm talking about white folks, because the majority of them, and you probably, think really honest to God that you are white, and you're not. And you're having a problem with that. But you got to pierce that. I'm not talking about white privilege, which is just another code word for white supremacy. I'm talking about you got to pierce, one, the reality that you ain't white. And there's paper, there's scholarship about this. You go back into the 1920s and 30s, the 1880s and 90s, where there are lists. They categorize who is at the top of the heap, who's at the bottom. Yes, the nigga is always at the bottom. Yes, black people are always at the bottom. Don't matter where you from, except from Egypt. But most of those were Arabs by then. Ethiopians, too. A couple of other smaller groups of people. But anyway, yes, the European rates very highly. However, all Europeans were not considered white, and to be considered white, you had to fit a certain bill, and the majority of you do not fit it. If you recall, in 2012, there was a photograph circulating, two photographs, one of Mitt Romney's family, one of Barack Obama's family. Barack Obama's family was very, quote, diverse. There's many different people there. And then you look at Mitt Romney's and it's nothing but white. And I'm talking milquetoast white. The same thing with Trump. Milquetoast white. There ain't no color in there. Except in his orange spray tan. There's a reason for this. There's a reason for this. When you talk to a lot of these people, they still think they're white. And they ain't. But the broader challenge is getting them to get that what we are now, what this country is now facing, is built from the 60s. It is built from the overturning of the revolution. It is built from the overturning of the human rights, the black rights. You know, I often go into the human rights thing because I'm so used to hearing it, but it's really the overturning of the black rights movement. The fact that black people were saying enough is enough. It's an overturning of that. And you get people to understand that and to work from that that point of view, because that's where all these people, Rush Limbaugh and all this other nonsense, the fair and balance of Fox News and all of that comes out of that. It took 10, 15 years to really get it ramped up, but the book Republican Noise Machine goes into that. I mean, it was cancerous how they really went in to explode first black rights, which, if memory serves me correctly, it's been a few years since I listened to the book. The Republican Noise Machine, you know, it didn't focus on that, but it focused on the, quote, left. But it basically went in and it wanted to break up the anti-free enterprise, which is a joke and a half. But basically the anti-big business block of people, and to turn them against their former ideology or their former philosophy, which was equality, at least financially and monetarily, but it wanted to overdo that. And that's what that was all about. Everything has come from that. And basically the country is stuck. It's stuck there. It's stuck there. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, well, Bill Clinton basically was the 80s candidate in the 90s. George W. Bush might have been the 80s candidate, might have been the early 90s candidate in 2000. You know, he was basically trying to finish off what his father had done. And then Barack Obama was the 90 president in the late 2000s. You know, the cool black kid that everybody wanted to know. So that was from the 90s. And then after, you know, that pissed enough people off because, well, OJ. And then they were like, well, we're done with the 90s. Let's go back. So now we're back in the 80s. Possibly back in the 70s, but I'll say the 80s. With Donald Trump, who was Mr. Yuppie Man. I mean, he was the guy that all the yuppies wanted to be. Young urban professional class. It was who all the yuppies wanted to be. And I don't find that coincidental. I think psychologically, this country, the white nation, is convulsion. I think it's convulsing. And they are stuck. They're stuck in these year loops, because generationally, they have no direction. Things are getting bad, and they're not capable of confronting why they're actually getting bad. And that's really looking at themselves and saying, you guys have made some really poor choices. You have. And you got to fix those choices, or else things are going to keep getting worse. You should have not voted for Reagan in 1980. You should have not voted him in. Should have invested heavily in green technologies in the 80s and kept investing in it. Should have built strong black communities instead of tearing them apart in the 1960s and 70s. And you should have at least implemented national health care in the 60s, in the 50s, when everyone else was doing it in the Western world. Should have continued updating infrastructure, putting heavy taxes, well, not heavy, but good taxes anyway, on big business, locking them into staying here, not believing the hype that they are people and can roam and go wherever they want to. But you didn't do any of that. So now there's a cumulative effect. And you get Donald Trump. See you on the other side.
When we were younger, we used to sit on my porch and talk smack about girls in professional sports. And there's a lot of things I wanted to say, but never got a chance to find a way. Take a good look at all of our high schools. This is the first reason that I wanna write you. It must be tough when society is messed up. Gotta save money, please don't take it out on us. Do they even know? Do they even know? If I was brave, I'd write a letter to the president and have him pass it to the leaders of our parliament. But but for now I won't say nothing. Now that we're older, a brand new story unfolds about God and the laws that we've always been told. And there's a lot of the things I wanted never got a chance to find a way. Do they even know? Do they even know? If I was brave, I'd write a letter to the president and have him pass it to the leaders of our parliament. But for now, I won't say nothing. From all the kids who would stand in my residence, who see this letter as a statement of our innocence. As for now, I'll start with something.
How you doing, family? Another installation here. Of course, I think everybody knows about what Bannon said this week about the media being the opposition party. I want you all to do me a favor. Indulge me. get a clean notebook, one subject. And I want you to put it somewhere accessible. You can either, you know, it could be one subject, it could be a spiral notebook, a large pad. But make sure that you can write on both sides of the paper and that it is accessible to you constantly. Because what I want you to do is every day, I want you to keep a rolling tab. Write down what Trump does or what is said by his press secretary or somebody in his cabinet, you know, to the extent that you can do it, okay? So let's say 3 or 4 times a day, just write one thing down. Write it down. Don't have to go into great detail. Just a quick note. What is it? And then underneath it, indent a little bit and write down how it is hurtful. How it's hurtful. Just really quick. Maybe violates, let's say, for instance, what Bannon said today. So Bannon said, or excuse me, what he said earlier in the week, I think it was Wednesday, when he said that the press is the opposition party. So write down, first line would be, in quotation marks, press is the opposition party, and then Bannon, and then the date that it occurred, and then underneath it, violates the First Amendment by seeking to muzzle the press. Then who it hurts? Who it hurts? It hurts all Americans, perceivably. It hurts all Americans by stopping them from getting access to information. Just keep a rolling tab. Why? Because 6 months from now, you can take a look back, and within a month or so, you'll be able to categorize all of that information. You'll have your own little category system set up. So Bannon says something, and Trump says something, or does something. Maybe his press secretary does something, or his chief of staff in the military does something. And you'll be able to categorize all of that stuff. And you'll have a running tab of what is actually going on. But also, you'll have a whole list of, well, some of them will be crimes, and just a whole list of information for you to be able to draw on. Then I want you to consider something. Because I'm imagining the majority of you who are listening to this are up in arms because either one or two things. Either you are people who are being directly affected by this stuff. And I'm not talking about broadly and impacted like, oh, well, the First Amendment, by violating that, that could stymie my free speech. No, I'm talking about a person who actually works in the press. So they're directly impacted by that. I'm not arguing semantics right now, so let it go, please. But, so, the person who works in the press is directly affected by that. Or, you are a person like a Mexican, a Hispanic, who could be picked up at night, picked up and deported without any due process or anything like that. It's just, you're illegal, get out. Then I want you to consider something. I want you to consider something that Gerald Horn put into my mind. I think it was not right after Donald Trump was elected. I think it was about 2 months before he was elected. He gave an interview and he was talking about the precarious position the United States found itself in all these years. Whereas the mantra of the United States is, this is a great democracy. He pointed out that every 4 years and every 2 years, the argument of the white left is that we are close to slipping into fascism. And so he asked the question, and it's a very apt question, is this country democracy? Is it a democracy, or is it actually more fascistic than it wants to admit? And after doing some quick thinking of just my analyses over the past 3 or 4 years, and some of the things, some of the episodes that I've done even for this podcast, I had to really, I was hesitant, but I had to admit, it seems that the United States of America is not a democracy. And it is not, as some people would like to argue, it's a republic. It's not a republic. Oh, well, because I think it was Plato who said that a democracy is a degeneration of a republic. Of course, he was a rich man who feared the popular will, so he would say that. Every time when a conservative tells me that, I just want to smack him because the majority of them are poor. And I'm looking at him like, okay, so really honest to God, you sat down and you read Plato. Okay, you read nothing else of substance, but you read Plato. Yeah, it drives me nuts. Anyway, so I had to admit it, that this country definitely has a lot of fascistic tendencies. More. We have to remember the word fascist comes from the idea of fascis, which is a bundle of sticks tied together. It's a bundle of sticks tied together, which is even more amazing because what? In Italy, Italy used to be a hodgepodge of city-states. And then the city-states, through some great effort, were fused together into a country, which is Italy. Therefore, as one unified whole, they were stronger than being each individual city-state. It could be argued in a very simplistic manner, it is a fascistic organization. Maybe not in character, but definitely an organization. The United States is kind of the same way. The United States is, by its own admission, you look at what it calls itself, the United States of America. Well, it is a united bunch of states. So therefore, its whole concept is we are stronger unified than we are separated. That is fascistic. That is the whole idea of the fascists. So, in at least organizational practices, this country is fascist. It is a fascistic organ. However, culturally, I think there's a lot of arguments to be made for a police state, for a totalitarian state, for things like that. But is it fascist? It definitely, I think it has some underpinnings, but would it definitely be fascist? I don't know. Maybe I'll explore that more. See you on the other side. In this world of calamity, dirty looks and grudges and jealousy, and police will abuse them authority. Me the clowns when I know about variety. Boom, the youngest veteran, I go murder them slow. Ragamuffin sent to call me from the bush bungalow. When I watch it make a clear road, my voice now figure out. Emerge from the darkness with me big blood to glow. Me hammer them a slam and spectator get low. Some work with a big like Mamba Bigelow. Bust off trigger finger, trigger end and trigger toe. A two gun me up, me bust them in a stereo. Cause I got to keep on walking on the road to Zion. We got to keep it burning on the road to Zion.
us to go. Jah will be waiting there, we are shout. Jah will be waiting there. Clean and pure meditation without a doubt. Don't make them take you like who them took out. Jah will be waiting there, we are shout. Jah will be waiting there. You got to keep on walking.
Can't help but feel helpless. I'm having daymares at daytime, wide awake, try to relate. This can't be happening, like I'm in a dream while I'm walking. Cause what I'm seeing is haunting. Human beings like ghosts and zombies. President Mugabe holding guns to innocent bodies in Zimbabwe. They make John Pope seem godly, sacrilegious and blasphemous. In my lifetime, I look back at paths I walked, where savages fought and pastors taught. Prostitutes stomping high heel boots and badges scream at young black children, stop or I will shoot. I look back and cook crack, plush cars that pass by, Jaguars, mad fly, and I'm guilty for materialism. Blacks are still up in the prison, trust that. So save me your sorries, I'm raising an army. Revolutionary warfare with Damian Marley. We sparking the irons, marching the Zion. You know how Nas be, NYC, state of mind, I'm
in this world of calamity. Dirty looks and grudges and jealousy. And police where you abuse their majority. Media clowns when I know about variety. Single parents when need some charity. Youths when need some love and prosperity. Instead of broken dreams and tragedy. By any plan and any means and strategy. Say, I got to keep on walking.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that will do it for the end. Well, that will do it for today's show. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always drop me an email. I will be always happy to respond. This is what a time, man. What a time. All right, have a great week. I'll see you next week. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.